Our guest on The Year That Made Me today came to us courtesy of a listener. When we spoke with Jordan Himmelfarb recently about his book Interregnum, inside the grueling and glamorous battle to become the next king of chess, Jane texted in to say that we should get in touch with Irina Berezina, an international master of chess who's represented Australia at 8 chess Olympiads. And Irina won her first national chess championship in Ukraine at the age of 13. So, with thanks to listener Jane, I'm delighted to say, Irina Berezina, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Thank you very much.
Irina, I wonder if you could tell us about your family and your early life in Ukraine.
So I was born in former Soviet Union. We wouldn't say we're Ukrainians. We would like, we were, you know, lived in a country which was consisted of 15 countries and the St. Petersburg, which used to be called Leningrad and Moscow. And we lived in a small apartment. By Australian standards, it would be called two-bedroom apartment. Three generations, my grandparents, my parents, my older brother, 5 years older than me, and a good chess player too. And me, and a dog, and a fish, and birds, and everyone in something which used to be called Khrushchev's apartment. And we thought we are very lucky, we are very happy. Kyiv was very beautiful. And at the age of about 4 and a half, my father started introducing to my older brother, who's 5 years older, how to play chess. And I was just running around as a normal kid. And I listened. And then I picked up by some miracle. And then my brother was taken to the chess school. And grandma took us, and I was next door doing dancing. And at the end of the lesson, I had to stay and wait for my brother to finish chess lesson, and I start answering some questions, and a chess coach said, "Who are you? Come here, talk to me." Then he said he wants to see my parents, and he told my parents that no more dancing, no more anything. It's a future world champion. She's accepted into class with all the kids, and that's where my chess started. Believe it or not, the interesting part of the story. Out of all countries in the world, my chess coach immigrated to New Zealand. My first chess coach.
There you go.
Immigrated to New Zealand. He wrote a couple of beautiful chess books. He was a captain of a national New Zealand team. And then he had a second child born in New Zealand. And his second child, a daughter, got married in Sydney. And my chess coach is now in Sydney. My first chess coach was around 90 years old, beautiful, we still talk to each other.
Ah, that's beautiful and amazing.
And he's a very special person.
And he spotted you at a very young age, Irina. And now, I'm interested to know, clearly your brother, your older brother, had showed some promise in chess as well. So how did your parents and your brother react to the chess coach spotting you as a future talent?
Look, if I would travel to chess competition, since probably year six, I start traveling a little bit alone with a chess coach and a group of kids. Every day I had to call, and the first question, whole family would be next to the phone. How did you go? And I would say, I won. And my grandma would scream, oh my God, you smart little. And I guess as a child, the memory of when your parents, your grandparents, your brother, your everyone around supporting you in what you're doing, giving you some other skills to fight in life. Look, I'm not sure why. Maybe partly because we didn't have that many opportunities in our life. It's not like we were given tennis lessons, swimming lessons, everything. Maybe that's a part of that. We had basically our hobbies were reading books, and playing chess became something really, really special. And I think to play chess, like, for example, my brother is a genius and I'm more of a fighter. Okay, so I mean, he writes books about chess. He's an amazing chess coach, but playing takes much more out of you.
Absolutely. So clearly, chess was a huge part of your childhood and your family. Did your parents play chess as well?
Look, in former Soviet Union, everyone played chess. Okay, I guess it was totally normal. The same, like, you look at the history of chess in France, like, for example, Napoleon Bonaparte, he played chess before every battle. It's a fact. He was traveling with a chess set, okay? So let's say if you'll just Google some pictures, Paul Morphy, the first uncrowned American champion, he traveled through the whole world on a ship. He went to France. He played with the crown prince on a stage in Paris Opera House. And we can still see this beautiful picture, this women wearing this gorgeous dresses and everything. And the crown prince had advisor. So I think in former Soviet Union, chess were super popular. It's also where, so it's where 70s, when it was time of the Cold War and former Soviet Union wanted to prove how great we are. Also, it's very inexpensive sport. You don't need anything. You need any table, kitchen table, floor, anything, bed, and a chess set. And it was like, I couldn't imagine, I couldn't even dream about playing tennis back there. It was not a choice.
Well, clearly you had that strong competitive spirit. Chess notoriously is a place where talents are hothoused. What was it like for you growing up as an elite chess player?
Yeah, look, I mean, I have to admit, now when people are saying, oh my God, it's so stressful, it was lots of stress, I thought it just, I'm having a dream life.
Yeah.
Wow, you know, what else I can wish for myself? Except winning more games and achieving more what I want to achieve. And look, it was officially in former Soviet Union, it was no elite chess. But the truth is, it was elite chess. So, for example, our family was very normal former Soviet Union family where from the wages to the next wages, you had to survive on bread, if you're lucky, butter, milk, whatever. I remember how my parents and grandparents would whisper how they would manage to feed the family until someone will earn money. And being already, as you said, elite in sport, when I start playing well in a chess competition, they would give me, it's like a little piece of paper and saying breakfast, lunch, dinner to the cafe or the restaurant to go and eat a little bit better than normal people.
So chess was literally a meal ticket for you.
Yeah. But, you know, the fun part is my grandfather would go with me because he was very interesting man and he was, I don't know, he was a very special person. And we would go to this cafe and he would walk in with, say, 10 tickets for 10 days. And he would say, can we please, instead of eating here, can we please exchange these tickets for extra sugar, bread, butter, salami, cheese, and whatever we could take it home. And then we would come home with all this chocolate and gifts and all my family so happy. We have full fridge, you know? And I felt, oh my God, I'm just like 12, 13, 14. I'm helping. I'm already earning money for my family. You know, like I'm doing something good for my family. You know, and I could see their happy faces that my grandma doesn't need to take a piece of meat and make stuffed cabbage rolls for the whole family and lots of rice because it's cheap.
On the Year That Made Me, we're speaking with Irina Berezina. Irina, we're talking about your teenage years as a chess prodigy. Who were your chess idol?
My chess idol was Bobby Fischer, and it was big no-no. Actually, as a junior and a representative of Ukrainian team, in a live interview, I was asked exactly the same question. I said, Bobby Fischer. When I walked out, they said, you probably won't be in the team anymore.
Right.
I'm like, but it was hard to, I guess it was hard to explain to a young kid, why can't I say what I really mean. And I got a book, 500 of the games of Bobby Fischer, and really it was like literally a copy. And during the summer holidays, I was sitting alone and just studying Bobby Fischer games. And I was dreaming that one day I will be world champion or something and the chess master and I could do something with it. And look, I can't say that it was just hard or something. It was lots of enjoyment. Also, I guess it made my life much better than most of the kids who were just sitting in school. I travel whole former Soviet Union. It's just a couple of republics I've never visited. And chess were very much supported by government. Look, it wasn't business class or you know, like fancy trains, but I traveled a lot. I met lots of amazingly interesting people. I stayed in hotels. I saw different city. I saw different culture. I went to, for example, on the day when a war started with Afghanistan, I was in a city of Tajikistan, Dushanbe, playing my first championship of USSR. No one knew that I was the youngest kid there. I was so scared to be in a hotel room. I couldn't sleep. And at night I woke up and I saw tents on the street because from Dushanbe, it was only little road into the Afghanistan.
Mm. And it sounds like it created a fascinating life for you as a teenager. What did you do, Irina, when you left school?
When I left school, I went into University of Physical Education and Culture.
And what did you study there?
Look, it was kind of a bit tricky. When I was going into university, I was extremely successful in chess. And in order to continue to study chess, I had to go for 5 years to study in a Ukrainian city of Lviv. It's on the border with Poland. So I had no choices. So I finished University of Physical Education and Culture as a sports teacher. So I'm recognized in Australia as a PE teacher. On my 1 month before I turned 20, I had a baby. And it was a decision. And decision was I kind of going to stop playing professionally. I probably not going to be a world champion anymore, but I'd rather have a family.
So you had your son at the age of 20. It's fair to say, though, I think that your marriage was a very chess marriage. Is that right, Irina?
Yeah, I went on a chess competition. My husband was an arbiter. We met and he's a chess player. He's a chess coach. He finished University of Physical Education and Culture in Moscow, did post-graduation in Moscow in coaching. So it's easy from the point that we do understand each other and he does understand what it takes out of me to play. And he was very supportive for me to continue to play and get back.
So, Irina, you have a young baby and you've put your chess career on hold for at least a short time. That means that in 1986, you were in Kyiv when the Chernobyl nuclear reactor exploded just 110 kilometers north at Chernobyl. How did you find out about the explosion and what impact did it have on you?
Yeah, that was terrible. That was really, really bad. So our son was 11 months old. We got a call from the neighbors. Then he said, look, just pack stuff, whatever you can, and just get out of Kyiv. And it was terrible in point that in May, it's a big demonstration in Kyiv. And we were encouraged to go out on the streets and whatever. And in the same time, they were saying, after you're coming home, please wash yourself, have shower, whatever. And then it became scary because, like, we went with my brother somewhere and we were under the heavy rain. And then people were whispering and saying the rain had lots of radiation. It was terrible. Then next day, my brother gets really, really sick. He's unconscious. We don't know what's happening. And my son started getting sick way too often. And we start thinking what we can do. We left Kyiv for about 20 days. We went to Moscow, stayed with some relatives, but, you know, we had to work. We had to have kind of normal life. Like it was no means and financially to stay somewhere else. In former Soviet Union, it wasn't easy just to go, even if you have money, and rent a place or live in a place. So we all had a stamp in our passport where we live, and we couldn't leave this place. But I think for a couple of years, we didn't really think about immigration straight away. We start thinking closer to 90s, when Gorbachev came to power, and I guess people who could and who thought before were feeling more confident that we can get out.
So how is it that you and your husband Vladimir and your son Alex were able to leave the Soviet Union as it then was and come to Australia?
Nothing was easy. My mother-in-law traveled to Australia because her brother was living in Australia and she was telling how beautiful and, you know. So we actually applied like a family to go all together and she wrote that she's got a brother living and it's like part of the family reunion. And then basically we were five times told that my x-ray got lost and I can't go. And I was kind of partly joking to my husband and my mother-in-law that, look, five times my x-ray was lost. We have so much radiation from Chernobyl. I don't need to have another x-ray. I'll die before I'll travel. And I said, look, maybe it's not meant to be. And then one day out of blue, I pick up phone and they're saying, hi, we're embassy in Moscow, Australian embassy. We just found your x-ray. You're actually the only one member of family who passed a points test. And you can immigrate, but because it was half a year lost, you have very limited amount of time to arrive to Australia. Otherwise, whole process has to start again. Unfortunately, your mother-in-law is not your blood relative. She's not allowed to come. You're allowed to take your husband and your son, and you can go. And I think we arrived to Australia on the 2nd of January of 1992. On the 4th of January, I think our visa would expire.
Wow.
So we wouldn't make it. That we would start this process. As who knows? It also was very financially tough. Also, we had to give up our jobs because we already were traitors. Officially, we are traitors. For everyone around, you're not a nice person, you don't want to live in your country, you don't love your country. Look, I mean, the decision was very, it wasn't simple to leave my parents and my brother behind, but it was a decision to give different life and healthier life to our son.
So obviously it was a huge and in some ways hurried decision to move to the other side of the world. Had you resumed your chess playing career when you left Ukraine?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a good part of that. First of all, with everything what was hard on the other side of the world, our chess education was amazing. And until now, if you'll read the chess books and the interviews, everyone would say Russian chess players, as former Soviet Union chess players, they were amazing. And then I'm coming to Australia and it was like, wow, it's so good. So I became a champion of Australia in a Queen Victoria Building ballroom. It was beautiful. I went to qualification to the World Championship, to Jakarta. So chess actually for me got much better in Australia. What can be better like playing on the first board for Australian national team and traveling? My first chess Olympiad was in Moscow. Yeah, I went to Moscow and I saw lots of friends and Ukrainian team and everything. Every time when it was anthem of Australia and I'm representing the Australian team, I had this, you know, goosebumps on my body. Wow. And when, for example, in Norway, our captain of Australian team said to me, oh, tomorrow we are playing Ukraine. You probably don't want to play your country. I said, no, I want to play another country. I'm actually here. Look, do I miss my family and everything? Absolutely. I can't see my brother. I can't fly to Ukraine. He can't come here. He's in a war zone. I'm checking on him every night and just asking, are you okay? And all this bombing and everything, it doesn't make my life easier. But this all that, getting back to your question, chess became much more interesting, successful, and I don't think probably the truth is if I would stay there, I maybe never would have this great chess career. That's the simple truth. It could have gone either way. Who knows? Because life was just really much harder there.
We're speaking with Irina Berezina, International Master of Chess on The Year That Made Me. And Irina, we've heard how you came to Australia and were able to build your chess career in Australia. That was in the early 1990s. And indeed, it's in the 1990s, I think, that you've chosen the year that made you. What year have you chosen and why?
Look, 1997 divide my life before and after. And I guess I don't really think about that often. I guess partly it's too painful and it's no need to constantly think about that. But yeah, that was a year when I nearly died. And it was learning to walk again, breathe again. It's obviously affected until now, everything, you know, like, I mean, I'm back to normal, but I'm not back to normal.
Yes, and that's because you had the extraordinary misfortune of being involved in the Maccabiah Bridge disaster when on the 14th of July, 1997, a temporary bridge that was constructed to allow delegates to get to the opening ceremony collapsed, and the Australian delegation was plunged into the toxic waters of the river below. Four Australians lost their lives in that accident, and 69 were injured, in your case, very seriously. Obviously, it was a hugely traumatic experience in every sense, but I wonder if you would mind telling us what it was like for you to go through that and about your recovery.
I was chosen as the best sportswoman of the year in New South Wales, and I was offered a trip to Israel as a part of that. We were hoping that I can win a medal for Australia, and we thought it's not extremely hard that it's possible, you know. And then we arrived to Israel. We traveled with the team. It was beautiful. We had unbelievable green and gold uniform. And then we were supposed to go to opening ceremony. And then they're on the stadium and it's total excitement. And then I didn't know we are on the bridge. Then we're standing somewhere in the middle in a row. They're saying, okay, start walking. Boy with the Australian flag walking in front of us. Next, it's just like one scream. And if you can imagine, so the bridge was about like a three-story apartment and you're falling down. So in a second, I guess I realized we are underwater. I realized that I want to free myself, but I can't. And something falling on the top of my head. You know, like it's just seconds and that's it. I can't see because lack of oxygen, I lost vision. And later on, my husband said that even if I could see, I would faint anyway because my ankle was 180 degrees torn apart and turned around. And because I actually regained consciousness but not vision, they saw that I'm okay and they had lots of other people to take care of. And then my husband came to visit me. And they said that he cannot visit me, that it's got turned to the world. They didn't realize that my lungs were filled with the water, water was poison. They had to put me in induced coma. And the scary part was, I don't think my brain was completely killed with induced coma. And I thought, oh my God, they probably think I'm dead. I need to move my finger and show them I'm not dead. But, you know, I couldn't. And so then it's weeks in a hospital, breathing was problem, talking was problem. They were kind of, doctors were very much straightforward. They were saying, look, we don't think you have big chances. If you would like to see your family before saying goodbye, that's the time now. They were like so straightforward. I couldn't believe it actually. I don't know how did I do it. Yeah, so Israeli airline gave free tickets. So my brother flew from Ukraine. I told my husband that my son was very angry with me. Look, at this time, he was 12. And he was on the way to airport. My parents couldn't go with him and he was going to see. And I said to my husband that if I'm going to die, and that's what kind of looks like, I don't want him to see and have a memory for the rest of the life because it wasn't a pretty picture, believe me. And my son told me later that it was the scariest moment of his life when later on from intensive care was allowed to get out with the oxygen and just give a quick phone call to my family in Australia. And my son was saying, when I heard you, how you talking, that was the scariest moment. It was like, you know, like when a person couldn't breathe. Then on day 17, they told me that my leg has to be amputated. And they said, sorry, but we can't even give you anesthetic because your lungs are not capable of doing anything. So we'll do epidural and we'll operate leg. And I could see faces and I wasn't asleep and it wasn't fun. But they did put it together somehow. And it was fun arrival in a wheelchair back in Australia. Yeah, I was second last to arrive back home. and then wheelchair, walking frame, boot, another surgery, and then learning to walk, and then saying, I want to wear high heels again.
But obviously, despite all the adversity and the pain, and no doubt because of your intensely competitive spirit and commitment, you were able to recover and indeed return to high-level chess. I think it was only a couple of years after that that you became an international master. Is that right?
Yeah. I became women international master early, but I became a man international master, which is not many women scored this title.
Amazing. Well, thank you for speaking about what was obviously a traumatic but significant year in your life, Irina. You've retired from competitive chess now, Irina. I wonder if you look back over the many, many years that you've played, is the time that you played your best chess also the time that you most enjoyed playing the game?
Look, first of all, I kind of retired for, I guess, COVID speed it up. I also hoping that next year I'll be back. I'm not thinking about retirement. I'm playing chess. I'm teaching chess. I am enjoying chess maybe even more than before. I guess the best years, funny enough, in chess career were actually after the accident. And it's very interesting. I think psychologically, you're giving yourself permission to totally relax because you're so happy. I am alive. Hello, I am alive. That's all. I can do lots of things and I'm here. And then you're playing a little bit more relaxed and you don't maybe putting over pressure. It just through COVID and then I lost both of the parents and I kind of didn't want to miss this time with mom and dad. Look, I don't know. I'm hoping to stay healthy, happy, and get back to chess and still play for Australia. And if I won't be able to play for Australia, at least I think I can make a good captain of Australian team because I know all, kind of, you know, I can be very helpful. But I still play on internet. I played online for Australia on Zoom for, you know, Chess Olympiad online. So, look, you cannot take chess out of, you know, like it's in the system. So if I'll officially retire, I will make an announcement. But at this stage, I'm not officially retired. My plan is to help my son visit two beautiful kids whom I love a lot. And I want to teach them chess. And I want to for them to see that their grandma actually is still playing, better than ever. Everything is good. You can do it.
Well, Irina, you really have had an extraordinary chess career and an extraordinary life, and it's been fantastic speaking with you. Thank you so much, especially for speaking about some of the really difficult parts of your life, which you've been so open about today. Thank you for being our guest on The Year That Made Me.
Thank you, Julian. Thank you.
And we look forward to you potentially returning to the Australian chess team, whether it's as a player or coach. That's good news for Australian chess. But we always finish The Year That Made Me, Irina, with a piece of music. What piece of music have you chosen for us and why?
So the name of the song is Million of Red Roses. And it was originally, the singer was Alla Pugacheva, who is a very famous singer in former Soviet Union. Unfortunately, she's the persona non grata together with her husband and living overseas at the moment because she escaped from the country at the beginning of the war and she's not supporting war with Ukraine.
Irina Berezina, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.